Accession number 8668, roll number 5.
Jackie Mockridge, reel 5. You ferried to the maintenance units at the end of the war.
Yes, now the maintenance units, they would keep them there, and then when the bomber squadrons or the fighter squadrons needed anything, then they would immediately tell Home Command what they needed, and Home Command would send out ferry pilots to these various units to pick up the aircraft that were now, while they were waiting there, being fitted with all sorts of things. Radar, for instance, which they started fitting, and they were all very secret. There was this little thing that was covered over, and when you went to collect an aeroplane, that had been fitted with radar. It didn't tell us what was radar. Afterwards, we found out. They would say, you mustn't lift this cover off this particular instrument, and if you land anywhere, you know, blow the aeroplane up, because we don't want anybody to find out about what's in this little box. And it was the secret radar that the aeroplanes could see ahead. They were going to bomb like the Blockbusters and those sort of people, I think.
How were you supposed to blow the airplanes up?
Well, I suppose you just light a match to the petrol tank. I don't really know. But what they meant was, you know, don't let anybody come near that particular little gadget there, which looked like about the size of a cushion, covered over, stuck up near the pilot on the side.
Were you happy to continue ferrying after the war?
Oh, yes, I would have gone on forever. It's the most happiest time of my life, is war. It's a terrible thing to say, with everybody dying left, right and centre. But I was terribly, terribly happy. Very much in love, doing a job I absolutely loved, which was frightening, but it gave you that sort of thrill. And for the first time in my life, I felt important to somebody or something or a country, whereas I wasn't a little insignificant, ugly little girl that you know, everyone used to say, oh, well, you know, she's no good. She's not going to be any good to anybody.
Can you tell me about your demobilisation?
Yes. Do you know, it's hard to remember having been. See, unofficially, I was really still in the Air Force. I hadn't actually been taken out of the Air Force. So it was almost like I could have gone back into the Air Force if I'd wanted to. They just gave us I can't remember. I think one day we were flying, and the next day they said, well, that's your last aeroplane and you can go home. In fact, so much so that I can't even remember, unless I look at my logbook, one of my 6 logbooks, and I don't know where they are now, which one was the actual last aeroplane I ferried.
Can you remember how you felt when you were told it was over for you?
Well, I would have been shattered, except that because I was pregnant and I was married, I thought, well, you know, I'll be all right now, and I've had all this experience, and I can go and get a commercial license. And so I got my commercial license. I studied for it while I was having my baby, actually, and I finally got it after several attempts in 1948. And you know, to be a professional civil pilot.
What did you have to do for that license?
Very great deal, cost a fortune, and a lot of studying. You had to do 13 subjects, all to do with navigation, engines, aero navigation. You had to know the aircraft you were flying, or the one you wanted on your license. They allowed you sort of to study one particular one. You also had to know how to do everything, really. It was a very thorough. If I hadn't had my background of all the studying I'd done before since I was 14, I think I would have found it much more difficult. But because I'd sort of come into it and had all this experience. The only other thing which amazed me was that your flying experience had nothing whatever to do with your examination experience. And if you put down in your examination what you would actually do in the air in those circumstances, you'd have failed. In fact, I proved it. Because they wanted you to just write down what you'd studied in a book. And I felt it bore no relationship whatsoever to what you actually did in the air. And that's the only thing I had against all that studying. They've modified a lot of it now, and you don't have to learn a lot of stuff that you never use. You had to learn You even had to learn the flag signalling, and you had to learn, of course, you had to learn Morse code, both flashing lights as well as the sound. And you had to know a lot of, I mean, you had to be quite good at that. Something like 16 words a minute for the, which is quite a lot, really. And, well, if you didn't pass, you didn't get it, you see, because in those days, it wasn't all done for you. You had to actually recognise your beacons by the Morse code and knowing which one it was.
Whereabouts did you do this training?
They had navigational schools all over the place. I had a navigational school just behind Harrods, very expensive, and I couldn't really afford it. I sold everything I had, you know, to do it. And very difficult to find someone to look after my child as well and all that. And I didn't have any relations, and my husband's family didn't approve naturally of me wanting to go on flying. So I was, once again, not only rationing was I was starving because I was putting all my money into the navigational classes. Anyway, I only went to the actual classes for about 1 month because I studied like mad on my own, knowing I couldn't afford more than a month. And when I did the month's course, and we were doing, and the tests were all held at the Air Ministry in a big building, you know, and all terribly frightening, really. And you all sat down, and, you know, you were timed in the minutes and all this, and it took a week, and you had 13 subjects, and sometimes you'd do three in a day, and sometimes you'd do two, and so it was a very strenuous time. And they all said, well, I'll never pass, the boys said, because after a month I didn't have enough training, because they didn't know my background, they didn't know I'd done a lot of studying. And the day I sat for my exam, I had a high fever the night before, but I didn't care. I had flu, I realise now, at the time. And I went and sat there with them. They all said how well I looked, because I was absolutely scarlet with this fever. Anyway, I only lasted 3 days of the week or so that it took. And I was very surprised to find that I'd passed. You also had to do flying tests, of course, heavy flying tests. This didn't involve just one aircraft, you know. You had to know how to fly on instruments, and you had to know how to fly different types of you had to hire these aircraft, you see, and I had to get, I had a higher expensive twin-engined aircraft, that sort of thing, so that cost me quite a lot of money. But I had to do that if I wanted to get a proper professional license. And eventually I managed to pass, and I was very thrilled about it. And then I had to find a job. Well, I also had an instructor's license, so I did a little bit of instructing, but I didn't like that very much. I managed to get a job doing taking people up for flights, and then I managed to get in with a small charter company and did that. But none of them, they were such little aeroplanes that I hated, you know. I found them, well, they used to make me feel airsick. They were so small and bumping about all over the place. And I didn't feel like a professional pilot doing that sort of stuff. I wanted to get on an airline, really. That's what I really wanted. And then the Air Force decided that you could join the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. Sorry, the Women's Air Force, Royal Air Force Reserve. That's what it was called then. But it was attached to the Men's Royal Auxiliary Air Force. And mine particular one was at Filton. They had the Auxiliary Air Force at Filton, so I belonged to that mess. I was the only woman there. And the first day I went for my flight that I joined up as, they didn't know anything about you. And you joined as a pilot, you see. And they thought you probably had a few hours. So he took me out to this particular Tiger Moth, the Air Force examiner. And he said, now that's the throttle. Now, you know, that's the control column. That's the rudders and things and everything. And then he said, now we'll go up and we'll have a little flight test. He said, I believe you've done a bit of flying. And I said, well, yes, you see. Now, he hadn't looked at my logbook or anything, although I had to produce it, but like all pilots, you never have time to look at anything like that. We took off, and then he said, he took off, and then he said, right now, fly her straight and level. Now, this is ludicrous, me with about 3,000 hours and all the experience I had. So I flew it straight and level. Well, that's very good, he said. Now do a turn. So I did a gentle turn, then a steep turn. Anyway, we went through the whole thing. And then he landed it and when we got down. And then he said, well, that was very good. He said, it won't take you long to learn. And then he went and looked at my logbook while I had tea. And he came back to me and he was terribly embarrassed and very flustered and very annoyed. How dare you let me show you where the throttle is and fly straight and level when you've got all these hours, he said. What sort of fool do you think I am? And of course he didn't know me, he didn't realise I didn't have the nerve to tell him. I mean, I didn't know what to do. You know, I was too embarrassed and always had this fear of authority, you know. So anyway, he subsided afterwards and he was very nice to me and he said, go on, take the aeroplane, go and fly it. And don't, you know. And after that, we all flew in formation and used to go to various places and we had various tests and checks and things. And it was another very happy time of my life. Twice a week we used to fly, Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then we'd have also twice a week, we'd fly in the daytime. And then in the evening we'd have lessons, all with a view to getting our RAF wings in the future. But they told me, of course, you know, the men would get them, but the women didn't stand a chance of getting wings, you know. We knew that. And then Jean Bird, who actually was junior in the flying world to me in the ATA, came in later than I did. A very, very charming girl she was. And we all loved Jean. And she, somehow or other, she said she was on parade one day when an air marshal was looking at them all or reviewing them or whatever they do. And he said, you're an ATA pilot, aren't you? Why are you wearing those preliminary RAF wings, like the ones I showed you on my book cover? And she said, well, sir, that's all we're allowed to have as women. He said, that's absolute nonsense, he said. She said, well, sir, we were told we could never wear them unless we did the wings course. And, of course, they won't let us ever do a wings course because we're women. Absolute rubbish, he said. And the next thing, he put sort of things into motion, and she was sent on a wings course. So Jean Bird was really the first one. And, of course, when my CO heard about it, he said, I'm not going to allow the London area to have everything. He said, we in the West are going to produce our first wings, Royal Air Force girl. So they were going to send me on one. But the difficulty was there was an adjutant who didn't like women. And he kept throwing the applications away. So they never got the Air Force, didn't get the application for the wings course, because he kept throwing them away. And it was great. Well, we didn't realise it for some time. And then I was sent to Exeter, and they said, the Air Force said that we've got to put you through the white ticket here and the aerobatic course. So I said, is that for my wings? And they said, well, we don't know yet. See how you get on. Well, I did that, and then I passed. And then I was sent to White Waltham on Harvard's, and the Duke of Edinburgh was having his flying tests at White Waltham at the time. I never actually saw him, but I met his pilot, Carol Gordon, who was training him. And so I was flying after he'd fly them. You know, I would fly the same aeroplanes. And occasionally he'd bring me home, Carol Gordon would, or I'd fly back here in one of the Duke's aeroplanes with all these stars on, you know. And we'd have the whole station out because they'd think it was the Duke arriving, and of course I'd get out, which wasn't very nice. But it was rather sweet of them to bring me home just so I could have, you know, 2 days with the family and then go back again. And so although we did the course at the same time, I never actually saw the Duke. And I did the aerobatic course and I got the green ticket then, which was the you had to have for your wings course, instrument ticket, you know, to say you can fly on instruments. And then I was sent to, and then the difficulty was now whether they were going to send me to Wellesbourne Mountford or not. This was 1953. And Wellesbourne Mountford was where the next wings course was going to take place, on Oxford's. Now, if you remember, Joan Hughes trained me on the Oxford for that 1 hour and a half. So, I mean, I'd ferried dozens of them, but it didn't make any difference because the Air Force do everything differently, including the way they fly. So, no guarantee that I would pass. However, somehow or other, I must have passed the aerobatic course on Harvard and the green ticket. But they thought they didn't think they were going to bother with me. I was the second one to get my wings, you see. and they didn't know whether they were going to. They had one girl, they didn't know whether. It was very, very tricky that time. But there was a very, very charming senior WAF officer at White Waltham at the time. This was in our home command, nothing to do with the ATA. And she said to me, you know, Jackie, I think, would you like to go and see some ministry or other? And we'll drive you over there. And I just want you to, them to meet you, because, you know, they've got this idea that you're some sort of woman who wants to walk over everybody and show off and, you know, that sort of thing. And she said, I'm sure that once they meet you, they'll realise you're just an ordinary girl who would like to be an RAF pilot, you know, and I'd like you to be too. She was a much older woman. She was an absolute darling, and, you know, I wouldn't have thought she'd have liked me, but somehow she must have seen something, I suppose, that she thought was, I don't know, anyway. So she sent me there, and she tucked my hair up all in a net, you know, because you weren't allowed to have it below the collar, made me look very RAF official, and sent me there. Now, this was the time when I was also trying to go through the sound barrier. That was what it was. It was this dreadful newspaper that's really why they decided, you know, they were humming and hawing about giving me wings, because of this newspaper person who'd stuck me in the front page of the Sunday Express, you know, and all that when I did that 600 miles an hour. All right, so, but, you know, they should have done it through the Air Force. Well, he thought he did. He was at the Air Force station, but he didn't do it the right way round. I don't understand publicity or how they should do it. All I know is I was photographed and shoved in the paper, and I didn't even know about it till it appeared. And I think that rather put everybody's backs up, you see, being a woman. Who does she think she is, you know, doing that sort of thing, showing off. And that's why. So she took me there to see these people, whoever they were. And I didn't do anything. I just went there and they asked me a few questions. And then this chap was telling me all about himself and how he'd flown through the sound barrier and everything, you know. And I didn't say anything because I didn't think there was any much hope anyway, so I didn't take any notes. And then afterwards, next thing I know, they sent me on to Wellborn Mountford for the ground course, which is all, as well as the course on the twin engines, and then later on the jets. And from then, I was presented with my wings after a month.
Were all these courses residential?
Oh, yes, they had to be. Yes, they had to be, which made life very difficult for me. You know, because I had to find someone to look after my child and pay them, and the salary's not all that good. So it was all very difficult.
And what did you have to do for your wings?
I had a lot of jewellery my mother had given me, and I used to sell them off, you know.
What did you have to do for the wings course?
Well, for the wings course, we had to sit an exam and do 13 subjects again. And that's where I made my mistake with the navigation. I did the navigational exam as I would do if I were actually flying it. And I failed it, so I had to do it again in a month's time. And he said to me, don't think. Just look at the book and answer whatever the book says, answer it that way. Because they don't want a pilot already. They want someone who's going to copy the book, you know. It's, you know, like history. They have to arrange it. So I did that way, of course, and then I passed. And then I had to do a test, after we'd passed the ground course, we then had to do the final test on a Harvard. Now, there were about 121 of us, and 11 of us only passed, including one pilot who was also a professional pilot like me, and he failed because he apparently was overconfident, so I was told afterwards, because I thought he was a very good pilot. But they said once he got onto jets, he'd kill himself because he wasn't a bit frightened. Whereas I usually was frightened, you know. And a frightened pilot's a safe one because they're concentrating, you know. And so then the examiner said to me just before we went up, he'd never seen any of us before. He was a squadron leader. And he said to me, don't think just because you're a professional pilot and all that, he said, that you're going to pass this easily because we fly differently in the Air Force and we are very particular. And I'm afraid you have to be damn good before you think you're going to pass this exam. Now, telling me this, I was nervous enough as it was. However, I went up, and this was Wellsbourne Mountford, which is near Stratford-on-Avon. and we had to do 3 landings and takeoffs, and each time he'd cut the engine just as you took off, and you'd have to do the circuit on one engine, and an Oxford isn't very easy to hold on one engine, especially for a woman, because there's no help. And anyhow, it nearly killed me, but I did the first one. Now, with all the men, they only did one, and he passed them or failed them accordingly. With me, I did the first one with perfect, and he said, oh, that's just luck, we'll have another go. The next one was also good. Oh, well, he said, we'll have another one for good measure, hoping my leg would give out, you know, because we have to press the right rudder so hard. And I don't know how I ever did it. It really nearly killed me. My leg was nearly paralyzed, but I managed to stagger around and landed the third time successfully. And he said, well, I'm very reluctant, but I fear I shall have to pass you. Those were his actual words. I'm very reluctant, but I fear I shall have to pass you. But don't think I'm going to give you an exception. He said, I'm going to give you a very, very much average. I didn't even know they had different ways of passing people. And he finally signed it in my logbook that I'd passed my wings test. And then we were presented with our wings with a big ceremony about some time later. And somebody had to come down and present them to us and everything. And he was held up and couldn't do it, so the station commander in the end had to give us our wings. And somebody took a photograph of me. And 20 years later, in the RAF news, somebody rang up and said, oh, Mrs. Morgish, I didn't know you lived in Taunton, but there's a thing in the RAF news, the recruiting office rang up and told me, and I believe it's about you, did you know? And I said, no. So he brought it up, and it said, Equality, Jackie gained it more than 20 years ago. And there was this picture of me being presented with my wings that I'd never ever seen before, which was rather sweet.
How did the other students react to you being there?
Well, there were 11 of us that passed. They were very, very nice. I was amazed. They were younger than I was, because they're mostly about 19, 20, you know. And that's for 1948, I was, 1953. I'd be 31, yes. So, you know, they were very, very nice to me. And I somehow or other, I always did get on well with men, I suppose because I didn't tend to be one of them.
Were you assessed in your wings course to be a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot? Or?
Well, they put me, because I did the twins, they put me as a bomber pilot then. But afterwards I did the jets as well. So then that was on I was considered as a fighter pilot then. They didn't seem to say, really, not like they do with the men. They gave us a thorough grounding, which I suppose everybody gets. Not everybody did their wings on a twin, I don't think. I'm not sure, actually, about whether they do it on twins always or whether they're just that particular. Anyway, that was the last wings course of the Royal Air Force on Oxfords, and they scrapped them for that after that, so nobody else did their wings on an Oxford after that.
What difference did having your wings make?
Oh, I was thrilled to bits. First of all, the Air Force said they were very pleased because I could then show some of the young men who were very frightened to fly the jets, the Meteors, and that's why I went on those, because I could make them feel that if I could do it, and small as I was, what are they frightened about, you see? So they were very pleased about that. They used to have me, when they'd have a new set of recruits, they'd have me doing a couple of circuits, and then they'd say, there you are, meet flying officer Jackie Mogridge, who is, you know, just like you, and in the Air Force, and got her wings, and she's a girl, so if she can do it, you shouldn't be too worried, and so on. And then they sent me on to go and take on a little aeroplane, and I used to take the, what do they call them? They go for rides, these little air cadets, and take them up for rides everywhere, all over the place, and try and recruit the women to join the Royal Air Force, not as pilots, but, you know, just hope that'll encourage them to join the Air Force. And funnily enough, I ended up at Prestwick one day, and who should I meet but the man who has twin legs, Douglas Bader. And he was there one day, and it was a terribly foggy day the next day when we were going to both take off. And he was going to Ireland, and I was going to Newcastle. No, he'd just come back from Ireland, that's right. He was going to Newcastle, and so was I. And he looked at me, and I thought I'd make a joke. And I was wearing my full RAF wings. And he was flying a little airplane for his company, and he was just up there really to play golf, you know. And I said good morning to him. We were both waiting to collect our papers to say we wanted the airplane. And he looked me up and down, didn't say good morning, although I said good morning to him. And the little man, the engineer man behind there, you know, made a face at me as if to say, don't take notice of him, he's a grumpy old thing. And he then said, where are you going? Those were his first words, you see. So I said, oh, I'm going to Newcastle. He said, well, so am I, but you're not going to get there today. The weather's terribly bad. You'll never get there today. The hills are covered. Impossible. You'll have to decide to stay the night, like I'm going to do. So I said, yes, yes. But I knew that I had to get there, and you know, I'd disappoint all those poor kids who were waiting to get lifts. So I said, well, I'll wait and see, you know. I said, it's only a little aeroplane, it's not very fast, so I can probably manage to get through the valleys and somehow find my way there. And he said, well, I suggest that you don't do it. You know, just like that officious sort of manner. And again, the little engineer man winked at me as if to say, and then he turned to Douglas Bader and he said, sir, I'd like to just tell you that this young lady here has brought many aeroplanes into us all throughout the war, big fight bombers and fighters, and she's got a lot of ours, sir. In fact, he said, I shouldn't be at all surprised if she hasn't got more flying time and more aircraft than you have. Of course, I blushed absolutely scarlet. Douglas Bader, he was livid. He really was. He just turned on his heels and walked away. And never said another word. And I said to this engineer chap, oh dear, why ever did you say that? I said, he'll hate me forever. And he said, I can't stand there, he said, and see the way he was talking down to you about flying that aeroplane. He said, I can't bear it, he said. And anyway, he said, he's a very aggressive man. He may have flown with 10 legs and all that, but he said, you know, after all, he did it when he was doing his own flying. He didn't do it in the war. You know, he was just playing the fool and in a light aeroplane and did it. And so, and I felt so embarrassed. And I thought, oh, Lord, I'm never going to get there now because I shall feel I've got a jinx on me. Anyway, I said, I went out and I got in my aeroplane and his aeroplane was parked next to mine. And I said, he said, you're going then? So I said, well, I'm only going to do a circuit and if I don't like it, I'll come back. So he didn't say another word and I took off and I managed to get there because, you know, we had got that sort of experience, let's face it. And apparently he didn't get there that day. He took off as well, but he came back. And it sounds awful to run a man down like that because he was a great man. I mean it like that. But it's just that, you know, the little engineer, you had no need to be so rude to the engineer chap. And he was just getting his own back at him through me, unfortunately. But that is the attitude of the males to the women, you know.